Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Sister Janet Ferns. If you are not trustworthy with what belongs to another, who will give you what is yours? The words of Jesus in the Gospel challenge all of us to honesty and integrity. One man whose integrity was unquestionable was the late Vietnamese Cardinal François Xavier Nguyen Van Thuan. The cause has been opened for his canonization exactly 5 years to the day after his death. In today's programme, Joan Lewis and I look back at this and the recent Vatican statement on euthanasia. First, however, we reflect on the Gospel for this Sunday, in which Jesus challenges us to be honest.
Jesus said to his disciples, "If you can trust a man in little things, you can also trust him in greater, while anyone unjust in a slight matter is also unjust in greater. If you cannot be trusted with elusive wealth, who will trust you with lasting? And if you have not been trustworthy with someone else's money, who will give you what is your own? No servant can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or be attentive to the one and despise the other. You cannot give yourself to God and money."
From the parables of the merciful love of God, that of the lost sheep, the lost drachma, the prodigal son, Jesus passes on to parables on the use and misuse of riches. "What made him choose these particular themes?" queries Piero Bargellini. "Why so much insistence on the humble being exalted and the proud being humbled, the first being last and the last first?" "It was the condition of his listeners," explains the writer. "In particular, scribes and Pharisees, priests and doctors of the law. If the exalted had been worthy of being exalted, the prudent sheep better than the lost, the obedient sons more just than the prodigal, there would have been no need to address the subject. But those listeners who were also his enemies believed themselves superior to other men, sinners, tax collectors and the like, while guilty themselves of hypocrisy and greed. The Pharisees loved money." Luke doesn't mince his words. But to give them their due, there was more to it than that. A note by one biblical scholar reminds us.
"The Jews mistakenly thought that misfortunes were always God's punishment, and that wealth was always a sign of his blessing. The richer they were, the more righteous did they think themselves. This idea made them go to all lengths to ensure that this sign of divine protection, wealth, should never fail them."
After recounting the parable of the unjust steward, our Lord says something which has an echo of the parable of the talents. "If you can trust a man in little things, you can also trust him in greater." The man who entrusted his property to servants and received interest from those to whom he'd given 5 and 2 talents praised them, saying, "You have shown you can be faithful in small things. I will trust you with greater." It's interesting that the word faithful is used here in the sense of having proved worthy of trust. In the Gospel today, while the version we've heard and the Jerusalem Bible both use trust, "if you can trust a man," and "the man who can be trusted," the Revised Standard Version reads, "he who is faithful in a very little," and the Vulgate, "he that is faithful in that which is least." In the second, negative part of this opening statement, the Vulgate uses the word unjust, as today's version does, "he that is unjust in that which is little," whereas both the Jerusalem Bible and the Revised Standard Version have dishonest. I wonder which word comes closer to the original. Now we come to the thing itself, what is often jokingly called filthy lucre, a phrase which St. Paul used in all seriousness in his letter to Titus, warning him of those who are ruining whole families by teaching things that they ought not to, for filthy lucre's sake. Today it's rendered as "with the vile motive of making money." In his first letter to Timothy, Paul states that a presiding elder must not be greedy of filthy lucre, in today's phrase, a lover of money. Originally, the word lucre had no negative undertones, meaning simply gain or profit. Only later it came to mean dishonourable gain. Today it's almost always used in jest, though the word lucrative can still be spoken without suggesting dishonest practice. But temptation hovers always in the wings, as when Samuel's sons, whom he had appointed judges, turned aside after lucre and took bribes. Money, as we call it today, has many names and has been given many labels. Money has no smell, we were told. Money talks, some said. And today everyone talks of money. But in my childhood we were not allowed to talk about it. It was considered vulgar. In the Gospel version we heard today, it's called elusive wealth. The Jerusalem Bible calls it money, that tainted thing, while both the Vulgate and the Revised Standard Version use the old word, mammon, the unjust, the unrighteous mammon. And in the final line, the celebrated phrase, you cannot serve God and mammon. Mammon is generally described as the god of this world. In Aramaic, mamona, or mammon, meant riches or gain. In Syriac, riches. While according to St. Augustine, it was Punic for greed. But for John Milton, writing in Paradise Lost, mammon was the personification of the evils of wealth and miserliness.
Mammon led them on. Mammon, the least erected spirit that fell from heaven. For even in heaven, his looks and thoughts were always downward bent, admiring more the riches of heaven's pavement, trodden gold, than aught divine or holy else enjoyed in vision beatific. By him first men also, and by his suggestion taught, ransacked the centre, and with impious hands rifled the bowels of their mother earth for treasures better hid. Soon had his crew opened into the hill a spacious wound, and digged out ribs of gold. Let none admire that riches grow in hell, that soil may best deserve the precious bane.
The evil of miserliness was depicted by Dickens in the person of Scrooge in his A Christmas Carol.
Oh, but he was a tight-fisted hand at the grindstone, Scrooge, a squeezing, wrenching, grasping, scraping, clutching, covetous old sinner, hard and sharp as flint, from which no steel had ever struck out generous fire, secret and self-contained and solitary as an oyster. The cold within him froze his old features, nipped his pointed nose, shriveled his cheek, stiffened his gait, made his eyes red, his lips thin, blue, and spoke out shrewdly in his grating voice. A frosty rime was on his head, and on his eyebrows and his wiry chin. He carried his own low temperature always about with him. He iced his office in the dog days, and didn't thaw it one degree at Christmas.
One of the most quoted, or rather misquoted, phrases on the subject of money and evil is Paul's, usually rendered as, money is the root of all evil. There's even a song. But that was not what Paul said, or rather wrote, in that same letter to Timothy, where he called it filthy lucre.
People who are neither rational nor informed imagine that religion is a way of making a profit. Religion, of course, does bring large profits, but only to those who are content with what they have. We brought nothing into the world, and we can take nothing out of it. But as long as we have food and clothing, let us be content with that. People who long to be rich are a prey to temptation. They get trapped into all sorts of foolish and dangerous ambitions, which eventually plunge them into ruin and destruction. The love of money is the root of all evils, and there are some who, pursuing it, have wandered away from the faith, and so given their souls any number of fatal wounds.
The pursuit of money takes many forms, one of which is familiar to millions, the phenomenon of the gold rush. When gold was discovered in California in 1848, thousands of fortune seekers set out the following spring in covered wagons for the West. The 49ers, as they came to be known, travelled some 2,000 miles, and though cholera, starvation, and Indian attacks reduced their number, by the end of the year, 80,000 people had made it to the Pacific coast. In his poem The Spell of the Yukon, Canadian Robert Service reminds us of the movement in the opposite direction, the Klondike gold rush in the closing years of the century.
I wanted the gold, and I sought it. I scrabbled and mucked like a slave. Was it famine or scurvy, I fought it. I hurled my youth into the grave. I wanted the gold, and I got it. Came out with a fortune last fall. Yet somehow life's not what I thought it, and somehow the gold isn't all. There's gold, and it's haunting and haunting. It's luring me on as of old. Yet it isn't the gold that I'm wanting, so much as just finding the gold.
That riches can be a hindrance to progress in the spiritual life was admitted by Francis Bacon, Lord Chancellor to King James I, but accused of taking bribes, fined and imprisoned. Though later pardoned, he took no further part in public life, devoting his remaining years to literature.
I cannot call riches better than the baggage of virtue. The Roman word is better, impedimenta, for as the baggage is to an army, so is riches to virtue. It cannot be spared, nor left behind, but it hindereth the march. Yea, and the care of it sometimes loseth or disturbeth the victory.
Bacon was surely speaking from the heart. St. Paul told Timothy to warn the rich, not to set their hopes on money, which is untrustworthy, but on God, who out of his riches gives us all that we need for our happiness. Tell them to be rich in good works, he said, generous and willing to share. This is the way they can save up a good capital sum for the future, if they want to make sure of the only life that is real. Of all the many things Jesus said about riches, the most celebrated is the reference to the camel and the eye of the needle. How hard it is for those who have riches to make their way into the kingdom of God, he said, looking at the rich young man as he turned sadly away. And a church father of the second century, Clement of Alexandria, wrote a homily on the theme, Who is the rich man that is saved? Comments William Jurgens in The Faith of the Early Fathers, apparently Clement had wealthy people among his charges, for he takes the consoling view that when the Lord said, go sell whatever you have and give it to the poor, he didn't really mean anything quite that drastic. Professor Henry Chadwick, in his History of the Early Church, writes,
Clement wrote a special discourse to help Christians puzzled about the right use of their money and troubled especially by the absolute command of the Lord to the rich young ruler, if you would be perfect, sell all you have. On a rapid reading, it might seem as if Clement were merely a compromiser trying to wriggle out of the plain meaning of a commandment. But a fairer reading of his tract shows that he did not see the gospel ethic as imposing legalistic obligations, but rather as a statement of God's higher purpose for those who follow him to the utmost. What really matters is the use rather than the accident of possession. Accordingly, Clement laid down a guide for the wealthy converts of the Alexandrian church.
And here now is Clement himself.
We must not cast away the wealth that benefits our neighbours also. This wealth is at our disposal and is supplied to us as a sort of material and as an instrument to be well used by those who know how to do so. Its nature is to serve and not to rule. Let no one therefore destroy his possessions, but rather the passions of his soul, which prevent his making a better use of his property, so that he may become noble and good and be able to use these possessions too, in a noble manner. We must therefore interpret the abandoning of all a man has and selling all he has in this way as being spoken concerning the passions of the soul. He who considers possessions and gold and silver and houses as God's gifts and by using them to further men's salvation renders service also to God, who gave them and knows that he possesses these things more for his brethren's sake than his own, who is superior to his possession of them, not being a slave of what he possesses, who does not bear these things about in his soul, nor bound and circumscribe his own life to them. Who is able, if ever he must be deprived of these things, to endure the loss of them as contentedly as their superabundance? This is he who is called blessed by the Lord, and poor in spirit, ready to be an heir of the kingdom of heaven.
And let's end this serious and difficult subject with some reflections on a lighter note. Humorist Stephen Leacock's Summer Sorrows of the Super Rich.
In the course of each summer, it is my privilege to do some visiting in the class of the upper super rich, people who have huge estates at fashionable places where the country is so beautifully wild that it costs $1,000 an acre. Now, you'd think that the people who live in these great places are happy. They're not. They have troubles of which you and I and the ordinary people never dream. They come out to the wilderness to rough it and to snatch a brief 4 months' vacation between the strain of the Riviera and the pressure of New York. And then, right in the happiest season of the summer, they come up against desperate problems. Problem number one. What to do to amuse the butler in the evening? It seems that he doesn't play bridge.
The butler who was here last year was always quite content if he could be provided with a game of bridge and a run to New York now and then and a trip to see his brother in Vancouver. But the new man, Jennings, says quite frankly that he doesn't mind cards in the house, but they simply don't interest him. So what can one do?
Problem number two, how to get the chauffeur's collars starched. It appears that there have been very great difficulties about this.
It's very hard to get the kind of gloss that Ransom likes on his collars. There is, of course, an electric laundry in the basement, but unfortunately the laundry maids who do the work in it will not undertake any collars over 11 inches long.
Problem number three, what to get the cook to read on Sunday?
The trouble is she doesn't care for fiction. She evidently is a woman of literary culture somehow, because she said one day that she'd read the whole of Shakespeare and thought it very good. In the library, of course, there are all the new books, because there's a standing order with Spentano to send up £50 of new fiction by express once a week. None of the guests of the house ever care to read any book more than 3 weeks old, as they're quite worthless for conversation. An order was sent to Boston for the Harvard Classics, but the cook says she doesn't care for the way they're selected. The only compromise so far is to get her books about the South Seas. But they'll only last her 7 weeks, and after that, we don't know what to do.
My visits with my fashionable friends have been so much disturbed by perpetual conversation on these problems that I've decided to give them up altogether and to get back into my own class of society. I have some friends, real ones, who have a wooden house on an island where there's no electric light within 20 miles and where they use rainwater out of a barrel.
The course has been opened for the canonization of the late Vietnamese Cardinal Van Tuan, exactly 5 years to the day after his death. Joan Lewis and I now look back on this and also on the recent Vatican statement on euthanasia. Joan, we're back for another week.
And it's been a week of an awful lot of activities. If you just look at the headlines of some of the news in the days since we last did this show, we have the Vatican statement saying no to euthanasia, even in the case of a vegetative state, which you and I are going to talk about. We have the visit by the president of Sudan to Pope Benedict. Ireland's new ambassador, Noel Fahey, presented his letters of credence. A group of poor Clare sisters, whose monastery is within the territory of the pontifical villas out near Castel Gandolfo, were received by the Pope. Monday, the Pope received the officials of the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace. And to mark the fifth anniversary, the fifth anniversary of the death of their former president, who was Vietnamese Cardinal François Xavier Nguyen Van Thuan, and his cause for beatification was opened the very same day, so September 17th.
I was really excited about that because I was here at Vatican Radio when there was a launch for a biography of the Cardinal. Cardinal Martino was part of the group that was in the front of the room when we had that press conference and the book launch, and there are a couple of other cardinals at the back. But what really struck me was everybody present who knew him was absolutely convinced he was a saint.
I had heard that remark when the man was obviously still alive. He died in July of 2002. It just so happened, pure coincidence. I had been in the hospital for life-saving surgery. It was a very long hospital stay. He was right down the hall from me. There were four cardinals. Just walk out of my door, and it was like the College of Cardinals, unfortunately. But he was there and very, very ill, knew he was going to die, bore this with such grace and such dignity, offering his sufferings up. I distinctly remember being told that he was trying to offer his sufferings up for Pope John Paul. This was July 2002, and the Pope was going to Toronto for World Youth Day. And the Cardinal was offering his sufferings up. And frankly, his very example, he had been a prisoner for so many years, 13 years, in the Vietnamese communist imprisoned him for 13, nine of which were in solitary confinement. Just knowing his life story, knowing his sacrifice, and how he treated people, the love, the charity, the how he practiced his faith was a huge example.
Because Cardinal Van Tuan had some amazing stories when he was in prison as well, didn't he?
He had some amazing stories, and he even smuggled out messages, and he smuggled out prayers that he had written. And I know that those have been released in books, The Road of Hope and Prayers of Hope. And in fact, Pope Benedict Monday, when he received the members of the council, as I say, to mark the anniversary of his death, but more importantly, to mark that very day, the opening of the Cardinal's cause for beatification, talked about the word hope is in both of these titles. Mm-hmm. And also the Cardinal did preach the 2000 retreat for the Roman Curia and the Pope. And those speeches were all bound in a volume. All three volumes have the word hope in their title. And that's exactly what the Pope highlighted in the Cardinal's life. And it had to be hope. It had to be faith that there was a living God who would either get him out of this, you know, situation he was in prison.
Well, what struck me listening to that press conference that time was that it seemed as if when he went into solitary confinement, rather than being withdrawn from the world, he had a much more intense involvement with it.
He did, in the way that he prayed and thinking about the world and thinking about people and thinking about situations. He didn't have access to news or something like that, but I mean, there's always, well, certainly his own country. If anybody needed prayers, it was his own country. And so the Pope highlighted that aspect about him too. The Pope told the people that he met Monday from the council, he spoke of this singular prophet of Christian hope. And he highlighted Cardinal's cordiality, his capacity for dialogue and for being close to everyone, his fervent commitment to spreading the church's social doctrine among the poor, and how it was thanks to this spiritual energy he resisted all physical and moral difficulties. And I got the most amazing letter from a Vietnamese man who had known the Cardinal, who had suffered in a very, very similar way to the Cardinal. And he came to Rome. He was able to finally, someone gave him a ticket. I don't remember that part of the story. He did come to Rome. It was the Jubilee year 2000. The Cardinal, when they had first met, had said, if you're ever in Rome, please look me up. And he meant it. And this man knew it. And so he went and looked up the Cardinal. Not only did the Cardinal receive this man and members of his family in his office and talked like old friends, he took him out for a meal. They prayed together. It was a very beautiful experience. So it backs up what you've said, what the Holy Father said about his cordiality and being a part of people's lives in a way that they absolutely never forgot. And one of the things he loved to repeat, and the Pope pointed this out Monday, he said, Cardinal Van Tuan loved to repeat that Christians are people of the here and now, of the present moment, which must be welcomed and experienced with the love of Christ. And his capacity to live for the present demonstrated his intimate abandonment in the hands of God and the evangelical simplicity we all admired in him.
Talking about the life and death of Cardinal Van Tuan leads on very well to our next topic, because right, euthanasia has been very much in the forefront of people's thoughts this week.
Well, it has simply because of a Vatican document reiterating the Church's no to euthanasia, even in the case of vegetative states. And this was actually, it was a very brief document. I don't even know if I counted the words, 200 words, something like that. But it was actually two questions and two answers. It was a response to questions raised by U.S. bishops in 2005 by the Bishops' Conference on Artificial Nutrition and Hydration. But the first question was, is the administration of food and water to a patient in a vegetative state morally obligatory? And the answer is yes. The administration, even by artificial means, is in principle an ordinary and proportionate means of preserving life. So in this way, suffering and death by starvation and dehydration are prevented. The second question, when nutrition and dehydration are being supplied by artificial means to a patient in a permanent vegetative state, may they be discontinued if a competent physician judges with moral certainty the patient will never recover? And the answer to that question, may they be removed, discontinued, is no. And a patient in a permanent vegetative state is a person with fundamental human dignity and must therefore receive ordinary and proportionate care. Being human beings, we can look at a person with a physical handicap, with a mental handicap. We can look at a person in a vegetative state. And if they don't move, they almost look like they may be dead. They don't look what we qualify. We have our own definition of normal, a normal human being. And just take away the word normal, you still have a human being. You still have the innate dignity, and that's what they're saying here.
Well, not only that, if somebody is in a coma, very often they can hear.
They just can't let you know.
Yes, and this is why it's really important in just ordinary patient care, if you've got somebody who is unconscious, for the family to talk to that person, because the sound of their voice will very often register with the patient and help to stimulate them and perhaps bring them back to consciousness. And also, there's talk about this permanent vegetative state, but there are amazing examples of people who had been in these states for many years
that have,
and then waking up.
Exactly. And the congregation actually was reissuing this. This is not like, oh my gosh, look what they said. This is the first time. This is reiterating a well-established doctrine, actually.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think there's some, I believe that the bishops wrote in asking if this was a new principle declaration or was it the continuation of church practice. And the answer to the question is quite simply, yes, it's the continuation. This is absolutely nothing new. We're not just saying this now in 2007. Mm. We've been saying it for a long time.
Mm. And also what I think is important to stress is that once upon a time, hydration and nutrition were extraordinary means because it was a new development. Now they are ordinary. So there's nothing extraordinary
exactly
about continuing to feed and to give fluids to somebody even if that person is in a coma. It's just normal. I'll be with you next week.
See you then.
God bless. And so we come to the end of our program for today. You can hear it all again in whole or in its parts if you go to our website at www.vaticanradio.org/English. I'm Sister Janet Ferns. Until we meet again, may God bless you.
This is Vatican Radio, Laudato Jesus Christus.